You're listening to a special showcase episode of the Round Table Podcast. 20 Minutes with Sherry Priest. Hello, friends. I'm Dave Robison.
And I'm Brian Humphrey.
And you're listening to a special showcase episode of the Round Table Podcast, 20 Minutes With.
20 Minutes With is a segment in which Dave and I have the amazing honor to share the microphone with some really, really fabulous people. And today, our writer has spanned... I'm not even going to try to do the intro. So
Dave, I know, right?
Tell Holy us, smokes. Yeah, because it's pretty phenomenal.
It is. It's fascinating. Dear friends, for today's showcase, we have on the Skype line a person who I consider to be today's Alanis Morissette of the spec fic scene. All right. Now, her childhood was steeped in religion and parochial schooling, but she was introduced to spec fic by her father, who at that tender age of 10, got her the complete works of Edgar Allan Poe, a tome that was actually heavier than she was. And she consumed this thing voraciously. Now, we'll fast forward just a few years, and this precocious youngster has already written 5 or 6 books. Jump ahead a little bit further. As a teenager, she was a goth, which is amazing and no small feat considering she was living in Florida at the time. And it's kind of tough to pull off the whole goth experience with blonde hair and a suntan. But our guest host is a rebel, and she's got the juvie record to back it up. So step back, people. There's even rumors, and I'll just say these are rumors. There's certainly no substantial behind this, but there's even rumors, Brian, that she was a LARPer.
Oh, yes, okay. That took me a second. Yeah, I was thinking like fisherman thing for a minute, but no, yes. Live action role playing.
Yes, exactly. Yes. She's a renegade. She's a nerd. She's a goth. Do you see why we love her?
Now, I'm already all a Twitter.
Now, her first publishing experience in Georgia was less than pleasant, but that hasn't stopped her from crafting a vast literary catacomb of steampunk, horror, alternate history, southern gothic, and urban fantasy tales, as well as several nonfiction articles. Her first novel, 4 and 20 Blackbirds, was published in 2003 and kicked off the Eden Moore trilogy, which includes Wings to the Kingdom and Not Flesh Nor Feathers. Now, she also has another series called the Cheshire Red Report series about, I love this, a world-renowned thief who is a vampire with an ex-Navy SEAL drag queen as a sidekick. How can you not love that? That's awesome. Her work Sweet. Has appeared in several magazines and anthologies, including Apex Digest, Subterranean Digest, and George R.R. Martin's acclaimed Wild Cards universe. In her Clockwork Century series, yes, but wait, there's more. Clockwork Century series, she brings her complex and shadowed vision to the world of steampunk, creating a rich and many-layered alternate history set in America. Now, in particular, her 2009 novel, Bone Shaker, which kicked off the series, and is described, you're going to love this, Brian, as Jules Verne meets Resident Evil.
Sweet.
Yes. This book has stacked up a veritable cornucopia of accolades. It won the Pacific Northwest Booksellers Association Award, made the final ballot for the 2009 Nebula Award for Best Novel, was a 2010 Hugo Award nominee for Best Novel, and won the 2010 Locus Award for the Best Science Fiction Novel, and it's been optioned for a motion picture. So we may see the glory of our guest host's work splashed across the silver screen. And on top of all of this, she's an urban exploration enthusiast. And I'm just going to let that hang there and let you all hit Google, because that's freaking fascinating. Dear friends, all the way from Chattanooga, Tennessee, it is our great pleasure to welcome to the big chair at the round table, Sherry Priest. Sherry, you have so much going on. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us here at the round table.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm not entirely sure how to follow up that introduction, actually. You said I couldn't talk yet, but I couldn't stop laughing. So, sorry.
did I miss anything, or were there any blatant, egregious errors in there?
No, not really. I think you pretty well covered the gamut there.
Excellent. Good. I'm glad to hear that we left nothing out. So, Sherry, let's just get into this. I'm going to hit the timer on our 20-minute timer, which we never actually look at until it dies.
I don't think it really exists personally.
No, I'm telling you, it does. It's sitting right here in front of me. But let's talk and start our 20 minutes with Sherry Priest. Sherry, my first question for you is, in your story development, in the tales that you've told, you do a marvelous job of weaving the external events of the plot with the inner drama of your characters. And with a lot of new writers, like me, for example, we tend to focus on the events of the story, but have a difficult time really anchoring a character's inner story into those plot events. How do you approach your story development process to ensure that the character's story, their inner story, is relevant and engaged with that overarching plot of the story you're trying to tell?
Well, first of all, thank you.
Yeah.
I know it's a hard question to answer. I think the way I tend to come at these things as I can, I try to make sure that all of the characters are kind of symptomatic of the world setting, if that makes any sense. Like when it came to the steampunk stuff, because anytime anyone says I've read your book, I know which book they mean. I think I've had 12 or 13 published, but they always mean Boneshaker. So, you know, all right, starting with that. When I was trying to make this world where you know, advanced Victorian technology was credible, you know, things begin changing around behind it. And it's like, okay, well, this is what you arrive at, this world where these things are in place. Well, what kind of people do these things suggest? You know, well, starting with Seattle, you're at a port city. It's, you know, even before it's filled with poison gas and walled off, it's a port city. It's a place where lots of people travel. It was densely populated with Native Americans for thousands of years. You had a lot of mariners. You had a lot of pioneers. You had, there are like any number of ways that you can kind of look at a place and see what kind of people are likely to be there. And so I guess that really is just kind of the bottom of it for me. I try to start with a place and sort of build out from there. And I know that a lot of people prefer to start with a character or prefer to start with a plot, but setting has always been really important to me. And every now and again, someone will, in a review, talk about how it seems like my place setting is a character of its own. And I like that. I hope that people take that away from these things. But it really turns out to be the foundation. Like I was trying to think of... when I was doing Boneshaker, like, well, what kind of people would live in this city that is absolutely destroyed, and why? Why? What credible reasons could people possibly have for sticking around? Well, all right, well, let's see. Maybe people who didn't have anywhere else to go. Maybe the kind of people who find a certain freedom when in a place where no one is looking and no one is likely to come. Maybe people who... Well, the number one thing you have to do is give it a reason for people to be there monetarily. So I created the drug trade and the drug system. So now there's really an economic reason for people to be in there, even though it seems improbable.
Okay.
So you kind of start with that and go, well, what kind of crazy pants person would actually stick around for this? Because that's probably a pretty interesting crazy pants person.
That's intriguing, because we've asked this question of other authors, and I don't think anyone's ever presented the setting as the foundation for that. But that makes perfect sense. That makes absolutely good perfect sense. Thank you.
Keeping with the idea of character, especially setting as a character, but then, you know, utilizing that and finding somebody that fits within that. In an interview that you did with the Steam Geek crew, you talked about how you do at times use real people and experiences, at least as a basis for your characters.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Once you find someone who inspires an idea for a character, how do you extract the essence or the quality that intrigues you and then translate that into the construction of a fictional character?
Narrative convenience. Really, I just kind of ignore what I don't like and take what I do like. It's not any more complicated than that. To kind of use an easy example, I did a character named Maria Boyd, who is actually pretty famous in the South. She was a Confederate spy, but above the Mason-Dixon and west of the Mississippi, people tend not to know who she is. So a lot of people on the West Coast, where a large bulk of my fan base is, thought that I'd made her up. But in fact, she was a real person. And I think by the end of the Civil War, when she was, I think, 19, by the way, She had killed a man who, she shot a Yankee soldier who assaulted her mother. She'd been in a POW camp. She'd been married, widowed, left at the altar, and had become so famous that she literally could not spy anymore.
At the tender age of 19.
Yes, at the tender age of 19.
Holy crap. Yeah.
Yes, it was absolutely insane. And so one of the things that I read about her that I thought was neat, the first time she got in trouble was kind of during the occupation and when the Yankees were kind of camped out at the house and nobody likes it. And so she shoots and kills this guy. And they didn't know what to do with her. You know, they couldn't send her to prison. She was a teenage girl. Certainly not back then. You don't do that sort of thing. So essentially what they did was they gave her a very stern warning. And they told her not to do it again. And what this told this girl, I mean, what she took away from that was, you know what, they can't touch me.
Yeah, really.
And she ran with it. And she became utterly fearless. And, you know, after the war, you know, her family was bankrupt. And she wrote a book about her experiences and did a speaking tour and took up acting. People accused her of being a prostitute. And I mean, she just had this amazing life. And she died fairly young. I think she was in her late 40s, early 50s, something like that. But I kind of got thinking, well, in this universe, if this woman is still around and the war's still going on, what becomes of this woman in her late 30s and her 40s? What happens to a teenage girl who was fearless and who had met all the success and notoriety as an adult? And so I sent her to work for the Pinkerton National Detective Agency in Chicago just because I thought that would be fun. I mean, there really is no deeper thing to it than that. I just thought, well, that would be really cool. What if we make her a detective? And then I did a little digging around, and I found out that the Pinkerton National Detective Agency was founded by a Scotsman who had been a union spy.
Oh, geez.
And I thought, you know, how neat that would be, all these old spies coming together and working for the Pinkertons, you know. So every now and again, I get email from people who think I've created this really too obviously modern woman. You know, obviously you're writing a modern character. You know what? No, I'm not.
Nope. Not
she was there. I mean, the truth to her adventures were actually much weirder than the biography that I give her in the books. I toned it down a little bit because I didn't want people to really
no
think I'd gone off the deep end. Right. No one would believe it.
Well, and it's interesting because you're also, you know, taking disparate threads of history and actually tying them together and creating a continuity of them, of actual historical figures that weren't actually associated with each other. That's inspired.
Oh, yeah. No, it's so much fun. And you know, the truth is that the things that have actually happened are so much weirder than anything I could make up.
Oh, my God, yes.
And so that's why I try and use, like, I start with some weird thing that I heard of or some weird person I heard of and go, well, all right, well, how does this work? How can I work this in? But really, it ultimately comes down to narrative convenience. If it doesn't fit, I just ignore it. I just pretend it didn't happen and hope nobody notices.
Do you have a collection of books like Weird History or Weird USA?
Yes.
Oh, good. I kind of figured
shelves
you might.
Shelves and shelves and shelves.
Now, Sherry, let me ask you, when you're at a party or at a social engagement or, you know, checking out at the grocery store, do you find yourself, do you find your writer brain engage when you look at somebody and say, you would make a great character for a story?
Oh, sometimes. More often than not, though, like I said, it kind of comes from the setting, but every now and again, I'm very fortunate in that I know a lot of really interesting people, and I've traveled a lot. My dad was in the Army, and I've moved around a lot even as an adult, and everywhere you go, you know, there are characters.
Sure.
And right now we've been talking about, I'm considering developing for some longer projects, the subject of a short story I did a few years ago based on a friend of mine here in Tennessee. And he's been a friend of mine since we were teenagers. He's a very big man. He used to love to wear these lift boots that made him about 6'5". And at his peak, he weighed nearly 500 pounds.
Oh.
I mean, he's enormous. Right. One of the sweetest people in the world. He's absolutely one of the nicest guys on the planet. But you see him coming, especially when we were teenagers, because he wore black head to toe and death metal T-shirts and, you know, and you just kind of didn't know what you were in for. But he's lovely. And we were sitting around talking once at this coffee shop we hung out at, and he knew I wanted to write stories, and I was writing books. And he said, you know what, I want to be a character in one of your books someday. I just want to be the heavy. I want to be the guy who walks on with a big gun, gets shot out of hand, and is off stage. I mean, did you even just hear what you said? You know, what just came out of your mouth just now? But years and years later, I was sitting around thinking about it. Because we're still friends, you know. He's been over to my house now. You know, he's really a really interesting a caricature of this guy. could be absolutely fascinating, but he can't be a walk-on part. He's way too interesting. And so I did this short story called The Heavy about a giant Tennessean monster hunter. And, he's just
I'll bet he loved it.
He takes on really big problems. Oh, he does. He has, like, everything it's ever been reprinted in, and it makes him so happy. So, and I'm glad, because he's exactly that kind of good-natured guy I can do that to. But more often than not, if I'm going to make a caricature of somebody, I got to veil it a little more thickly.
Sure.
So,
Yeah. Well, it almost seems to me that one of the things that you're touching on is what I see in a lot of young writing is, you know, I teach creative writing students, and so they have a tendency to find qualities that they like and they throw them in, but they don't give why the character is that way. And it seems like that's what you're doing, is you're answering the question of why, as opposed to just, this is a really cool characteristic, I want this to be in my character. You're going back and you're showing the things that have happened to that character that made them, or that gave them that quality. And that may be a kind of a pivotal difference. How much importance do you put to that?
Oh, well, quite a lot. I certainly hope that, that my characters turn out nice and round, you know. Even when you don't have a full background story on them, I hope that it's pretty clear that, you know, that things happen to them before you meet them on the page.
Right.
It's kind of like how when people do model trains and whatnot, they have little roads that disappear off the edge of the tracks and off the edge of the landscape to kind of give you the impression that things come and go.
That's
a
great metaphor.
I would like to hope that it best. Oh, thank you. Somebody who does model trains used it on me.
Yeah.
In an interview like this. So, I learn things when I talk to people like you. It's great.
Yeah.
That's why I like doing interviews like this. I like to talk to other people who are interested in the same wacky crap I'm interested in, and there you go.
And connections are made.
But nobody just is bad or is good, you know?
Right.
Nothing drives me crazier than, like, the motiveless monsters.
Absolutely.
This is just a monster that eats people. Well, why? Is it mindless? If so, that's not very interesting. What's its agenda?
Yeah.
The example I'll use off the top of my head is The Ring. The first 98% of that movie I thought was divine. The last 3 minutes made me want to throw the TV through the window.
You were cheated.
Right. Because
cheated.
After the big twist, now the monster doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Now it's just doing things because it's bad. It does things because it's bad. And
right.
And I thought, no, this was so tight, and this was such a great little mythos, such a tiny supernatural tragedy that, you know, that could creep and spread and be weird, and then 3 minutes before the end, we have to have a twist. And it infuriated me.
Sure.
Like, no.
Sure.
No, this
Absolutely.
Is great, and now
yeah.
it's not.
Well, and you run into the same thing. I mean, the whole brouhaha, or I hate to invoke a classic nerd discussion, but the whole invocation of midichlorians into the whole Star Wars.
Oh, God, yes. Exactly.
Over-explaining something. The other extreme, over-explaining something and literally demystifying it.
Right.
Same. I would also point to, because I'm an old goth, as you pointed out, I loved the Vampire Chronicles when I was a kid. They were my favorite thing. Oh, my God, best book ever, you know, when you're 15. And dark and tragic on the inside.
Of course.
But by about the middle of the second book, you know so much about vampires, and certainly by the end of the third book, where now you know all about their DNA sequencing, who cares?
Right.
Well, they're not interesting anymore because all the mystery is gone.
Right.
I want to understand the basic, the basic, you know, character alignment, but I don't need to know their lineage back 15 generations and what their cells look like and... it's just such a shame when that happens. You got to try and find the middle ground for that.
We'll be back with more of our conversation with Sherry Priest after this brief promotional break.
The Flash Pulp Podcast. 3 to 10 minutes of fiction brought to you thrice weekly. Now it's 3 apocalypses in one.
Yay!
Suffering from tough, stuck-on humans? Well, 20 hellish hours of suffocation in the all-encompassing web of Karwick the Spider God will get them right out. Too many brains lying around? The ravenous mouths surrounding zombie-fighting Ruby will quickly clean those up. Nosy neighbors? Infect them with the murder plague, and watch as they dissolve into paranoid maniacs bent on the preemptive assassination of their friends and family. Why stop at one end of the world when you can have all three? You can find them all at flashpulp.com or search for them on iTunes.
Now, let's get back to the conversation with Sherry Priest. Do you find in your writing, Sherry, that you cross that line of demystifying and maybe unromancing a concept, and then do you back off and or rewrite?
Oh, I'm sure. I do that all the time. That's what lots of drafts are for. Like, I've got a couple of characters right now that my editor, they drive my editor crazy, this one guy in particular, because he seems to be like this smarmy, sneaky kind of he knows everything that's going on. He's got to be bad. He's going to betray somebody somewhere at some point, only he never has. And he's actually quite useful. And she's just like, I just keep waiting for him to betray the whole crew, to you know, turn everybody in, to push someone off a cliff, and he just doesn't do it, and I don't know why he's like this. But I think he's fun, and I kind of, you know, like leading the reader on a little bit with this guy. But also, my husband just read Ganymede, and he complained about the same thing, so maybe I'm doing something wrong. One must always be open to this possibility.
Well, but, and it enhances the suspense and the worry, the anxiety, you know, when everybody knows this guy's going to betray them. When is that going to happen?
He has to someday, right? Yeah.
Well, not necessarily.
But I find it much more fun to subvert people's expectations of that sort of thing.
Totally.
To use that friend of mine who was the big scary looking guy and have him be, you know, this really great person who's kind of the hero of a story. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I like to do that, and I hope that sometimes at least I manage to surprise people.
Yeah. Definitely. That's the whole Mulder and Scully thing, you know, that
they're
going to kiss, they're going to kiss, they're going to kiss. And then when they finally do, nobody wants to watch anymore.
Show's over.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's done.
I think I'm going
to
put...
a little bit of an end.
I'm going to put subvert expectation on a t-shirt. That's right. A great pairing of words.
I like that.
Sherry, I wanted to ask you, there seems to be a growing number of shared world projects in the literary world right now. And apropos of your experience with George R. R. Martin's Wildcard series, what's your opinion of the shared world format? And during your time in working on that project, what were some of the challenges that you were confronted with, and what were some of the delights of playing in someone else's world?
Oh, God, that was, that was 6 months where I learned more about writing than a 4-year degree in English and a 3-year graduate degree in the subject.
Really? How so?
No exaggeration. It was phenomenal. I was learning at the feet of the master, you know.
Well, there is that.
Not to put too fine a point on it. King George, all hail. I got dragged into the project after the guy from Subterranean, his friend at George's, and George was talking about how in Wild Cards, he felt like the original crew, you know, we're all getting older, and he wanted some fresh blood in the franchise. And so this friend of mine at Subterranean is like, well, I know this, you know, woman who's pretty young, and she's a writer, and here you go. And so one day out of the blue, I get this package from somewhere in the Southwest, and I don't recognize the address, and I don't know what any of this stuff is. And I open it up, and it's a copy of Inside Straight with a letter from George R. R. Martin asking me if I want to audition to be in the Wild Cards Consortium. And once I quit flapping my hands and going like, you know, for like 20 minutes, I realized that there was like no email address or contact information.
Oh,
geez. So I figured he just meant for me to figure that crap out myself, and I did.
Here's your first test.
Yes, here's your first test. Figure out how to respond to this. Which I honestly don't think it was deliberate, or maybe it was. I don't know. But it was awesome. It was a crazy opportunity. And what you do is you kind of submit characters. And if he likes the characters, he'll go ahead and incorporate them into the canon. And then you start talking about stories and things when he brings them up. And once we're all in the consortium, and I was part of kind of a new wave. There were a number of other people who also came in around the same time. Right around the time Fort Freak was going to start coming down the pike. And we're kind of all on an email list. And he's like, look, I want you newbies to kind of sit back and participate, you know, pitch me for the smaller parts, but don't worry about the frame story, because that's a really big mess. And we try to leave that to the old pros. But here's going to be the setup. It's this old cop in New York, and he's about to retire. But he's haunted by this one last case that he wants to solve before he, you know, gets his gold watch or whatever, and go. And it had to be something complicated enough that it could span about 30 years. and support about 9 novellas, each one of which would deliver one of the major clues to the murder mystery.
Wow.
And, yeah, and it was epic, but I had a really great idea. And I'm like, oh, I know I'm not one of the newbies. They're not going to let me do it, but I'm going to try it anyway. So I did this little, like, one-page proposal for this thing, Remember the Rat Hole. And I sent it to him, and he emails me back and basically says, oh, no, 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 no. First of all, X, Y, Z, P, D, and Q. And I'm like, no, I understand, but what would it take for this to be good? And he says, well, you could try something like this or something like that. And I'm like, okay. So I go back and I do another draft. And I hit him again. I was like, ta-da! And I swear to God, his response was, okay, this is less bad. Okay, good. Well, I know I'm working my way up. Okay, well, what do I do to make it good? And finally, I think it was the 5th round, he said, stop. Just stop. Stop doing this. We're going to run with it. And, oh, my God, thank you. He's like, don't thank me. This is going to eat your life for the rest of the year. And he was right. But it was a fantastic rest of the year. The way it shook out, I had to write the framed story for this murder mystery around a series of novellas that had not been written yet, each one of which delivered a clue that I had to, you know, kind of write my way around using characters I had never seen before. Many of them had been invented for the book and had only dossiers for. And it was amazing. It was the most complicated challenge I had ever personally undergone. But, you know, when you have a figurehead who's a very strong editor and who has absolute veto and override and say, it can happen. And we spent, every couple of weekends, we'd be on the phone for about 4 or 5 hours and just going through the paperwork. I have an entire hanging file dedicated just to the characters and setting for that book, and it was crazy pants. I'm just not going to lie. It was exhausting. It was impossible. But he taught me how to write a murder mystery. At the end of it, I came out the other side, kind of feeling like I could take over the world because George R. R. Martin thought that I didn't suck.
Well, I love the fact that this is so like your characters in your stories. The big lord of mastery says don't, and you do it anyway.
Yeah, right. Just try it anyway.
That's awesome.
But that having been said, easy example, the very last line of the book, right? I was kind of having trouble with it, and you know, I've got the draft in, and we're on the phone. He's like, yeah, but I feel like the last line's a little weak. We need something that brings an X, Y, and this and that and the other. So it needs to be something more like, I don't know, this or that. The first thing he pulls out of his ass is fantastic. So I just wrote that in. No, you're right. That's good. I'm just going to use that. So if he wanted to make changes, absolutely. I absolutely defer to his superior wisdom without irony. I mean, he really knows what he's doing, and obviously. And having him tell me what was and wasn't working was absolutely invaluable.
Yeah.
But it was amazing just watching somebody like that work and having him show me how to do it. I can't buy it. Cannot buy that kind of experience.
So I take it you're an advocate of the shared world format.
Yes, let's say yes. But I know a lot of people who write for, you know, World of Darkness or, you know, WotC or whoever, and if you don't have a really strong central figure, it can become a problem. I've watched people, you know, fight and argue over how things are going to work when there's not a very clear hierarchy, and when there's not a very strong personality to whom everyone defers to. I don't know how that works. I'm not saying it can't and doesn't.
Sure.
Just that I can't really imagine being in that sort of a system.
Okay.
And I have been before with the job that I'm not allowed to talk about.
Yes.
That was a cluster. but it was a cluster because there was no clear hierarchy. And you had a million and one people who seemed to have equal authority and say. And it was a very difficult project that ultimately I was not able to complete. I would decline to renew the contract because it was just this Sisyphean task.
Sure, sure.
But with the right organization, I think it's an invaluable sort of production.
Okay, cool. Very cool. Sherry, the clock is giving me scowling looks, and this is going to push us over, but I have to ask this one last question.
I'll try and be quick.
No, don't. Because it's not that kind of question, I don't think. I don't know.
Nobody ever expects us to hit 20 minutes.
Yeah, we don't. So we don't even go there. Okay, here's the question. Why spec fic? You have dabbled in just about every subgenre that falls under the umbrella of spec fic, and beyond entertainment, beyond escapism, beyond the fairly front facing values of that genre, do you think spec fic is or can be of value in the context of, you know, society and culture, and if so, what do you think that value is?
Well, I kind of slid into all this a little bit sideways through religion. My parents divorced when I was very small, and my mom and dad had very different ways of looking at things. My mom raised me in a little-known denomination that when I'm feeling less than charitable, I call an eschatological cult.
Okay.
Only it's not, that's barely an exaggeration. I mean, you know, Jesus is coming back any minute now, and if you're not ready, you know, you're all going to hell, and your pets obviously can't come to heaven, and probably not your father because he doesn't love Jesus, and this friend of yours who I don't like, they're certainly not going, you know.
Right.
My earliest memories are of just living in terror, just absolute transcendental terror of Jesus, because apparently this guy's coming back to kick my ass. And I didn't really understand, and it was the sort of thing, it was kind of a pressure cooker of OCD, and eventually that kind of has to go somewhere. And I got into horror. It was very cathartic. Like, well, here is something, especially once I found Lovecraft. Yeah, the universe is huge, and it's awful, and it's going to eat you, but here's a really great story about some people who it ate. Oh, well, that's cool. But it gave some of those feelings an outlet. It gave me some place to offload some of that angst. And yeah, I lived in Florida and was a goth, and that was tricky.
Sure.
But I was a little more of a romantic goth. I had a lot of white, fluffy poet blouses and things, you know. But that's kind of how I slid into it. I came into it through horror. And then kind of, and which, of course, my mother was just appalled by. She kind of had this rule. Like, we weren't really allowed to have fiction in the house unless it was literature or Christian fiction. But her idea of literature was, you know, are the authors dead? And I know that doesn't make any sense, but there's so much about my upbringing that doesn't make any sense, but there you go.
Yeah.
And so my dad kind of figured out the workaround, which was when he started giving me, like, Edgar Allan Poe and Arthur Conan Doyle, and because I loved mysteries, too. I always loved mysteries. But my mom threw away the Nancy Drew books I checked out from the library, because I should have known better than to invite the presence of Satan into her home.
Dude.
And I wish I was joking. Yeah. That happened.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, you know, and then, like, once my dad ended up giving me a Lovecraft compendium when I was, I guess, probably 14 or 15. I don't think he even read it. He just thought it sounded like something I would like. But my mom didn't know who Lovecraft was, and she's like, now, I don't know this one. Who's this? And my dad's like, oh, this guy, he was writing back in the 20s, like Hemingway and,
you know. Instant credibility.
That guy. You know, that sort of thing. And my mom, being my mom, is like, oh, well, they weren't writing bad things in the 20s. I'm sure this will be fine. And so I kind of came into it that way, through sideways. And I think, especially when you tie it kind of into the, you know, take it back a little further in history, when you have the Greeks and their tragedies and the idea of public catharsis, I think that there is a direct line between Greek theater and the Hammer films. Basically.
Sure.
I think they kind of serve the same sort of function.
Okay. So there is a value there. There is a release valve, an exploratory nature.
Yeah, it's a pressure release and like, oh, well, you know, that was horrible, but it's over and I survived it. And you know, so sad for the rest of them. But yeah, you come out the other side and feel better.
Okay. Excellent.
That's awesome.
Excellent. Yeah. And now the clock has not only stopped and expired, but as it left the room, it mooned me. Sadly, we must call this to a halt. But Sherry, thank you so much. This has been an intriguing exploration into your world and how you see it. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, hey, thanks for having me. I'm happy to talk to you. I work from home by myself all the time, so anytime I get to natter on at somebody in a nerdy fashion, I'm a happy girl.
Excellent.
Oh, outstanding. Outstanding. Brian, closing thoughts as we take this 20 minutes with to a close?
It's interesting to me because I think that you know, a lot of these questions we've asked several times of other authors, and everybody has a different way to look at it, and it's good. And you do this really nice kind of you veer off just slightly to the side of it, and bring in a whole different perspective that gives us a little more richness. And so I really enjoyed this
very much
particular
so.
Interview. Yeah, I thought you did a really amazing job of giving us some new stuff to chew on.
And our listeners, I'm sure, are equally appreciative, and we are appreciative of them. Friends, thank you so much, as always, for hitting the play button. We'd greatly appreciate it. If you had a good time with us talking to Sherry, feel free to spread the word. That's probably one of the best ways that you can show appreciation for us. Let the world know that that we're out here and we're talking to some amazing people. You can swing out to iTunes, drop us a review, leave a note on the post on the website, www.roundtablepodcast.com. Drop us a line at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Don't forget that bit. And we're also on Facebook. Find us out there. We throw stuff up there that doesn't always make the website feed. So we'd love to connect with you and hear from you there. Stay tuned, guys. In a couple of days, we'll be back with Sherry as she workshops a story with us on the workshop episode. Until then, Brian, any suggestions?
Go right.
Go right. Go right sideways.
Yes.
Go right sideways. And go looking for amazing stuff, because, friends, you find what you're looking for. So look for the top shelf. Always, always, always. Until next time, thank you so much. We will talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown: Gary Gold, David LaBruyere, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com. Or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is @writerspodcast. Or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.